From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, NASCAR survivor Kaylee Lorenz on speaking before the MSU board and interim president John Engler.
Woke up that next day just feeling, you know, embarrassed that Mr. Engler said the things that he said. He made us feel like we did something wrong.
For anybody to look at someone like that telling their story and to think, I got to limit her to 3 minutes, and I'm going to cut her off, and I'm going to try to bully her. It just is an extraordinary failure.
If you want to be a homeowner in scenic Bayview, you must be a practicing Christian, and that has triggered a lawsuit.
If you are married to a spouse who is not a practicing Christian, and you happen to pass away, your spouse cannot inherit the property.
Our mission statement for decades has included the phrase that we're to be a community which provides a Christian perspective in a changing world.
Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thousands of Michigan Democrats packed into Cobo Center on Sunday for the party's endorsement convention, a day that had some rowdy moments. Our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta are here now. Rick, there were more than, 6,700 people there yesterday? How does that compare with past years?
Actually, it may be a record. We don't know for sure, but certainly going back to the 70s, that no one remembers this many delegates showing up for a Democratic convention like this.
So what does this tell us about where Michigan's Democrats are in 2018?
What it suggests is that the party may be fired up, engaged, and that Dana Nessel did a great job of organizing for the convention as she pursued the endorsement for Attorney General.
Zoe, what was the biggest story for you coming out of the day?
Dana Nessel. Dana Nessel. Again, this was an endorsement convention. Right. So we should say she is not officially the Democratic nominee for AG, but all, you know, T's crossed and I's dotted, basically party unity now behind Dana Nessel. And it was a huge, I don't know if upset is quite the right word. In fact, a couple weeks ago, we were thinking it was sort of Nessel's to win. And then the Miles campaign came back really strong over the past 2 weeks. 2 weeks ago, in particular, they filed this 68-page campaign complaint against Nessel.
Yes.
A lot of Democrats, too, in the past week were kind of just done with both campaigns, like folks who were not even sure they were going to go to the convention. I talked to many strong Democrats who believe in the party who are like, this is just dirty. We don't want anything of it. So I think it's kind of this twofold takeaway. Dana Nessel, first openly gay AG candidate, and then also, though, what the fissures going forward within the Democratic Party are going to be.
Because the UAW was completely behind her challenger, Pat Miles.
Pat Miles, exactly. And a lot of labor was.
Yes.
Now, Dana had a strong support from the LGBT community as well as pro-marijuana folks. And the Michigan Educational Association.
Well, Rick, what does this mean for organized labor, particularly the UAW, going forward?
Well, now, this is not the first time the UAW has lost at a convention, although it's a rare enough occurrence that it's certainly worth noting. But the UAW and the union movement in general have faced a quandary in recent years, which is they like the fact that they largely control the Democratic establishment in Michigan, but they also understand that they need to expand outside that by a lot if they're actually going to win elections. And so there's definitely a good news, bad news component to this as far as the UAW is concerned. But it does suggest that going forward, that the unions might not play quite as decisive a role in candidate selection, at least as they have in the past.
And we should note, Rick, that they endorsed recently, and there was some question about whether they would endorse at all. And I think folks were sort of surprised, like, oh, wow, they're kind of maybe going out on a limb here to support Miles, maybe thinking at the last moment it would be helpful. it didn't you know, push it, against the line, right?
Well, the UAW made a decision that it was more important for the union to at least attempt to be decisive than to hang back. And you know what? It was probably a good decision for them, all things considered.
Rick, what did we see from the candidates for governor as they were out there getting FaceTime with Michigan's party faithful Democrats?
We saw what we have seen around the state, that Abdul El-Sayed, despite some lingering questions over his eligibility, questions that might be settled by a court soon. This has to do with the fact that he was a registered voter in New York before he returned home to Michigan, but I digress, is still capturing the imagination of a lot of Democrats out there who just, like his intelligence and enthusiasm. There was a moment that some people found obnoxious when El-Sayed supporters tried to block delegate access to table manned by supporters of Sri Tanadar, who also, got in some quarters, especially the Progressive Caucus, kind of a raspberry from people who said that they question his Democratic bona fides. And Gretchen Whitmer basically went through the convention behaving as if she is the front runner many people believe her to be.
Yeah, I think that the big story actually out of the gubernatorial candidates was Sri getting booed out of the Progressive Caucus. You know, he has continued to say he is the most progressive candidate in the race.
His ads say that.
His ads say that. There are reports, though, before he actually jumped in the race that he was questioning whether he would run as a Democrat or as a Republican.
And he has made donations to Republicans.
Indeed, he has. So, yeah, I think, aside from Gretchen kind of in this acting, at least, as front runner status, Abdul's campaign standing, as Rick said, in front of the tables, which is just like, what is this, middle school, But then, yeah, Sri getting booed out of the Progressive Caucus. That's not good when you yourself are calling yourself the most progressive candidate.
No, it's not good. Although, he's still spending his own fortune in order to build his name ID.
And he is blanketing television.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And let's not forget that delegates to conventions will not choose the gubernatorial nominee. That will happen in the August primary.
Exactly. Final few seconds, Rick. How likely is it that we might see a heavily female Democratic ticket this fall?
Well, look, it's going to be at least 50% female because we know that the Attorney General and the Secretary of State nominees are female. Now the question is who the gubernatorial nominee will be. But if it's Gretchen Whitmer, then there's this question. Will she face pressure to really make it a historic all-female ticket? Or will the convention, which the August convention will also choose the lieutenant governor candidate, the running mate, engage in a process of ticket balancing and looking for a male to put in there, maybe someone who is African-American, because there is a lot of chagrin among African-American leaders that their candidate, Patrick Miles, didn't win the attorney general nomination. So that's what's next on that front.
Our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, Cindy.
You bet.
If you close your eyes and picture a mariachi band, you might see something like this. Sombreros, ornate black suits, stringed instruments, all worn and played by mustachioed men. Michigan Radio's Rebecca Kruth visited a group helping to bring women to the mariachi forefront in Detroit.
It's Saturday evening at the Plaza del Sol, a community and performing arts center in southwest Detroit. Camila Cantu is busy twisting the tuning pegs on her guitar. They catch the glow of the room's fluorescent lights as her brother Milo helps her find the perfect pitch.
Milo, can you play E?
Once she's tuned up, Camila situates herself on a folding chair in the center of the room's parquet dance floor. Tonight is just another night of rehearsal with the women's mariachi group she founded. Traditionally, mariachi has been a male-dominated genre.
Not until recently, in the past decade and a half, you haven't seen major female mariachi groups. And while that's starting to change, it hasn't really caught up here in Detroit.
When Camila was in middle school, she was recruited to perform with a youth mariachi ensemble in Detroit. She was the first girl to join the group in quite some time. She still remembers her first performance.
This one little girl, she came up to me and she was just like, "Oh my God, are you a mariachi?" And I was just like, "Yeah, like, yeah, I am." I'm like, "Do you want to be a mariachi, you know, when you grow up?" And she was just like, "Yeah, but that's for boys."
After Camila joined the youth ensemble, her mother, Maria Contreras Cantu, got involved too and eventually took over as manager. But before long, it started to feel like something was missing.
Well, Camila asked the question, why are there no other female musicians? Where are the females?
Camila pushed to recruit more girls. When a couple joined but didn't stay long, nobody seemed interested in figuring out why. It became clear to Camila that female membership wasn't one of the group's priorities. She grew more and more frustrated. Then, one day, someone showed her videos of an all-female mariachi group in New York called Mariachi Flor de Toloache.
That was the moment I was like, I want that. And I want that here, like in Detroit.
But Detroit didn't have that. Maria says what it did have were some pretty definite ideas about who can do mariachi and who can't.
I'll tell you exactly what it was. I believe it was females should be part of the band. Females can be in the band, but they cannot lead the band.
Eventually, Maria and Camila decided to start their own band, one that puts women up front. Today, Maria is owner and manager of Mariachi Femenil Detroit, and Camila is music director. The band is small, just 5 members, including 2 men. But one of the group's goals is to eventually be all female. Camila also wants to make sure the group's female members get a chance to do more than sing.
If you're a woman and you can sing, you're kind of just like stamped as a singer. Like nobody's gonna take that extra step to try to train you as a musician. I want them to be more than vocalists because that's what they want for themselves.
And attitudes toward female mariachis do seem to be changing in the community. When Mariachi Femenil first started, Maria says a lot of people would call to hire them and then change their minds once they found out the group was primarily female. But now she says it's more like this.
Is this the female band?
Yes,
this is the all females? Yes, we are. They want to make sure that they're calling the correct person. So opinions have changed, and that's because of the musicians. They have won the hearts. They have changed the minds of the people.
For Camila, that's a nice reward after a long, hard journey to the front of the stage.
The inspiration on the little girls' faces when they see us three, it's just, it makes it all worth it. Amor eterno.
With Cinco de Mayo, wedding season, and summer festivals just around the corner, there should be plenty more girls to inspire. I'm Rebecca Kruth.
Coming up, do you know how much in taxes you really pay? The answer may surprise you. Plus, the MSU board meeting last week that made national headlines. Stay with us. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you haven't filed your income taxes by now, you are quite literally waiting till the 11th hour. Taxes are due tomorrow. Well, here's something to chew on as we count down to that deadline. Most of us don't know how much we actually pay Uncle Sam. New research from Michigan State University finds a huge percentage of us think we pay way more in federal taxes than we actually do. One of those researchers is here with us now, MSU economist Charlie Ballard. Welcome back, Charlie.
Well, thanks for having me.
So you partnered with Sanjay Gupta, the dean of the Broad College of Business, digging into the public's perception of the federal income tax. How come?
Well, we thought this was an interesting question, and there is other research in other parts of economics and sociology that indicates that the broader public is often very misinformed about some pretty important aspects of our economy and our political system. So we thought it would be interesting to ask, what percentage of your household's income do you think is paid in federal income tax? And we asked that on MSU's State of the State survey, mm-hmm. which is a phone interview survey. We had almost 1,000 respondents. We then could calculate pretty accurately what their actual taxes are. Well, our calculations indicate that on average, this group of Michigan adults pay 13.9%. on average, they said that they paid 25.5%. In other words, they almost doubled it. And we found that 85% of our respondents indicated that they pay more in taxes than we believe they do. A few were pretty accurate, and a few actually underestimated, but 85% overstated their taxes.
Wow, that's major. Was there some kind of profile where there's some common denominators behind that 85% who overstate taxes?
Yeah, we did some statistics. We asked a lot of other questions about people's attitudes toward taxes and spending programs and other things. We found that people who believe that households like theirs pay too much overstated their taxes by more, which maybe isn't that surprising. You know, I pay too much, and so I believe that I pay a lot more than I actually do. Another group that overstated their taxes is those who use a tax preparer, those who use an accountant or an attorney or an advisor. Holding constant all the other variables in our data, that group overstated their income tax rate by a couple of percentage points more. And the last group that overstated was people who think that our tax dollars are spent very ineffectively. They tended to say that they pay a lot more in taxes than they actually do.
So how do you think we've seen these, frankly, misinformed and confused attitudes influencing debate over policies, for example, last year's tax cut, or into how people decide to vote? What do you think?
Well, it's entirely possible. I don't want to be too strong in my conclusions, but it's entirely possible that people are making their decisions about their view of taxes on the basis of misinformation. If it's really true, as our data indicate, that people believe they're paying a lot more than they actually are paying, then that could easily lend itself to support for tax cuts, even though I think, you know, you look at the tax cut that was passed in December, and the vast majority of mainstream economists thought that that was not a wise move at that time, especially since we were already running half a trillion a year deficits piled on top of more than $15 trillion of outstanding federal debt.
You know, you stop and you think when you hear anyone on television, any kind of political leader saying, you know, you're being taxed too much, I'm going to lower taxes. It's probably a little hard for someone else to stand up and go, no, taxes are good and we're using them well.
That is a very difficult argument to make, because the argument that we're paying too much is rampant. People get that message again and again, too much taxes, taxes are too high. Mm. And also you hear, oh, government money is wasted. Very common to say what President Trump said once recently. He said, I hate the way our government spends our tax dollars. But, you know, 90% of the federal budget is Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, defense, and interest on the debt. And, you know, I think a lot of people think Social Security is a good thing to spend money on.
What's the fix here? What do we do with this knowledge?
Well, the first thing we do with this knowledge is we talk to Michigan radio. That's the first thing. Get the word out. And I guess, let me go on record. You said that it's very hard for people to say in the current political climate, taxes are not such a bad thing. I really believe that at least households like mine, and my wife and I are fortunate enough to have a good income, we should be paying more. We really should, both for Michigan and for the federal.
Do I hear a challenge to our politicians to maybe change that message?
I'd like to see more politicians have the courage to explain to the American people that most of what the government does is stuff that has broad support, that we have to pay for it somehow, or if we don't pay for it, we will leave our children and grandchildren a mountain of debt, and we will leave them with crumbling roads, messed up sewers and water systems, and a whole bunch of other things. I believe that our children and grandchildren deserve better than that.
Michigan State University economist Charlie Ballard. Thank you so much, Charlie.
Always a pleasure.
Last Friday, an 18-year-old survivor of former MSU sports doctor Larry Nassar's sexual abuse stood in front of the university's Board of Trustees and interim president John Engler and made national headlines. Kaylee Lorenz accused Engler of privately offering her $250,000 to drop her civil lawsuit against the suit. And after she said it wasn't about the money, she says Engler said, well, give me a number then. And that he offered a dollar amount to survivor Rachel Denhollander. And as Kaylee Lorenz spoke, the interim president told her, time's up, stop.
President Engler then tried to back up his statement,
Kaylee, your
saying,
time is up.
Well,
we're Our time is up.
Kaylee Lorenz is with us now. Welcome, Kaylee. What were you feeling as interim president Engler told you to stop talking?
Yeah. You know, I was kind of shocked that he was stabbing me, that he was interrupting a survivor. And I thought it was just very hurtful. And I didn't really know what to do. I was, you know, of course I was going to finish my statement. It was important for me to tell the board and tell the MSU community exactly Mr. Engler's true colors behind closed doors. So, I was just very shocked that he was interrupting me and trying to make me stop.
So how has your weekend been after that memorable appearance before the board?
My phone has not stopped blowing up. You know, I've gotten a lot of text messages, family, friends, and people, you know, who I don't even know messaging me, who have seen the clip over social media or on news stations, saying, you know, how strong I am for standing up to Mr. Engler and, you know, not to stop fighting the fight. So it's been really nice.
Now, Kaylee, you spoke with Rachel Den Hollander about this claim of Engler that he'd met with her and she gave him a number?
Yeah, so after the meeting, my mom and I kind of decided, you know, let's sleep on it for 24 hours, decide if we're going to tell anybody about it. So we woke up that next day just feeling, you know, embarrassed that Mr. Engler said the things that he said. He made us feel like we did something wrong. So after reaching out to Rachel and talking to her, I asked her, you know, hey, have you actually met or spoken to Mr. Engler? And she said no, that she has reached out to his office asking if she could contact him or talk to him, and he has denied each time Rachel has reached out. So not only did he lie about meeting or talking with Rachel, she obviously never gave him a dollar amount, a settlement amount, because she has never talked to him.
The interim president released an emailed statement late Friday saying that he met with you and your mother, and I'm quoting him here, it was important to hear her experience as a survivor firsthand. Our memories and interpretations of the March 28th meeting are different than hers. I am sorry if anything said during the meeting was misunderstood. And in addition, MSU spokeswoman Emily Garant was in the meeting, and she told the Lansing State Journal her interpretation had been that Engler wasn't directly offering a settlement, but engaging in a philosophical discussion about what amount might be acceptable. What did that feel like to you?
You know, his statement after the board meeting, he, one, never denied anything that I said that he said, and it wasn't really an apology. He said that he's sorry for any miscommunication or misunderstanding, but that is no apology. And when he said, you know, right now, if I write you a check for $250,000, obviously I don't think he was going to sit there and write me a check, but I do think that he was just trying to get information that, you know, maybe if my attorney and I talked about a settlement amount, that I would tell him, that he would get the inside scoop, because we are going into mediation at the end of April. So I think he was really just trying to get information if my attorney and I have talked about an amount, which we haven't.
And it's worth mentioning your attorney was not with you at that meeting.
Correct. He had Carol Vivente in the conference room with us. And he introduced her as his, like, vice president and kind of like an assistant to him. And he never mentioned that she is his lawyer or what is on her business card as special counsel to the president.
Also, a point that was raised by Emily Garant, the spokesperson. She told reporters she doesn't remember John Engler mentioning a dollar amount during your meeting.
Yeah. You know, I listened to interviews that some reporters did with her, and she was mumbling over her words. She would say, oh, no, that didn't happen, and then would backtrack and say, oh, well, maybe, and then it was, okay, yep, that was said. So I'm not understanding how she can just backtrack and kind of try to cover the tracks a little bit. You know, there are five people in that room, and, you know, my mom and I know the real story. I have nothing to gain from this. You know, whether people believe me or not, I have nothing to gain, and I know the real story. The truth will come out.
You were very clear in your statement Friday before the board and in that meeting that it's not about the money. What do you want to see, Kaylee, happen at Michigan State University now and for the future?
You know, first I want to see to stop deflecting and defending, and to hold accountability and to say, you know what, you're right. MSU is wrong, and, you know, we need answers, and we want to see, you know, who knew what and when. I would like to see board members resign. I would like to see interim president Engler resign. I think that MSU needs a president who has experience or knowledge dealing with sexual assault cases and knowing how to handle them and how to make MSU a safer place. Because right now, if I were a student at MSU, I would not feel safe walking the sidewalks on that campus.
Kaylee Lorenz, we want to thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
One of the national sports journalists who wrote about last Friday's MSU board meeting is Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports, who's with us now. Dan, what struck you most deeply about that meeting?
Well, I think it was John Engler interrupting Kaylee while she tried to tell a story about John Engler. And for him to interrupt her, to say, your time's up, it's like he has no idea. I don't think he even knows what the phrase means these days. Tells me he's not paying attention to anything. I seem to say it without irony. Here's a young woman, 18 now, who at 13 came to a Michigan State doctor on the campus of Michigan State to be treated for an injury, a middle schooler. And she was went through, you know, her trauma and her assaults. And for anybody to look at someone like that telling their story and to think, I got to limit her to 3 minutes and I'm going to cut her off and I'm going to try to bully her, it just is an extraordinary failure in understanding the situation. And I think that's why John Engler is not never was a good choice for this. He is a very effective person in many things. Handling this situation at this time, the idea that you wouldn't just sit there at rapt attention. There's a very dismissive way he even listened to the story. I think it says all you need to know about what's going on at Michigan State and problematic, and why Michigan State alums and students would say, why do I want to be represented like this? This isn't what our school is about.
And you wrote in your piece for Yahoo Sports that this meeting, taking this meeting with Kaylee, you say was stupid on Engler's part, your words. How so?
Well, if you're going to take a direct meeting outside of attorneys in someone you're having a civil litigation with, and as the interim president, he's representing that body, you open yourself up to, you know, significant liability right there. But to do anything other than say, please tell me your story, and then say, gosh, I wish that hadn't happened, and be sensitive to it. To actually broach a dollar figure, whether it's philosophical or just an actual play, without her attorney present and all of that, just makes no sense. You either don't meet with them or you sit there and listen. And to go the route he did, it strikes to me as who John Engler is. He's a brass knuckle, you know, old school politician. He bullied people into getting his way as the governor. And whether you agree with what he got done or didn't, he was very, very effective. So there are talents that he has. But you don't do that with a kid that was molested by one of your employees when she's 13 years old. It's just not the time or place, and I don't think he ever understands that. And so it was stupid to take the meeting at all, unless you're going to sit there and listen and be sensitive, which he wasn't. And then once she's telling this story that's clearly embarrassing to you, to be dismissive about it and tell her to be quiet so more truth doesn't come out about it. He lied about what Rachel Denhollander said. You know, the whole thing is just absolutely ridiculous. It's like something out of a Hollywood movie that you would create this stuff. I didn't even believe it was true, except they didn't really blow back on it. He just sat there and listened to it.
Dan, how do you compare and contrast how Penn State handled the Jerry Sandusky scandal with MSU's handling of the Nassar scandal?
There are similarities between these two scandals. I covered that extensively, but they're not the same. And there are more differences than similarities. But I will say that after the fact, after everything's kind of laid out there, Penn State did everything they could to put this behind them. They were very sensitive public relations-wise. They tried to settle the lawsuits as quickly as possible. I think they looked at it and said, you know, we need to get this behind us. Let's settle. Let's say we're sorry. Let's implement all the things. Michigan State has not taken quite that route. They're certainly implementing what they can. But when you listen to Engler, you know, there was never anything from anyone at Penn State like what we saw last Friday, nothing even close. And if it's a different news environment, if it's the news environment of Penn State's time, right now we have Donald Trump in office, and cable news is 24 hours a day, Donald Trump. Whatever he is doing, it's all they talk about. If it wasn't, that video would have been on loop all weekend on cable news, and this is a whole different scandal. It's a different level of scandal. Most people aren't paying attention around the country to it. But Penn State took a very active role in trying to just get it behind them and trying to be sensitive to victims and get the money out there and do whatever they could at this point. Michigan State hasn't gotten there yet, and certainly the tone of the conduct and the comments, I'm going to have to raise tuition because of these civil suits. It's not because of the civil suits you might have to raise tuition. It's because one of your doctors molested 200 people. And so the whole tone is just all off. And I just think it's because you have a board of directors who decided to take a guy who just isn't fit for this job. It's the wrong guy for this job at this time.
Dan Wetzel is with Yahoo Sports. Dan, thanks so much for your time.
Anytime. Thank you.
The Boston Marathon has itself a new women's champion, and she lives and trains in suburban Detroit. Desiree Linden plowed through driving wind and rain today to reach the finish line in 2 hours, 39 minutes, and 54 seconds. Linden is the first American woman to take the title in 33 years. In a post-race interview featured on the Boston Athletic Association's Twitter page, she said this about winning: I don't have the right words. I'm thrilled. It's supposed to be hard. Congratulations to Michigan's own Desiree Linden, the 2018 Boston Marathon Women's Champion. Coming up, we'll hear both sides of a lawsuit unfolding in a small Michigan town where only Christians can own homes.
If you are married to a spouse who is not a practicing Christian and you happen to pass away, your spouse cannot inherit the property.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The resort community of Bayview is nestled on the shore of Lake Michigan. It is picturesque and it is divided. Bayview requires that to own a home there, you must be a practicing Christian and a pastor or church leader must verify you're a churchgoer. That rule has resulted in a lawsuit that argues it's discriminatory and violates the First Amendment, the Federal Fair Housing Act, and Michigan's Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act. We're going to hear from both sides today, and we start with Sarah Prescott, the attorney who filed the lawsuit against the Bayview Association of the United Methodist Church. Sarah, welcome.
So good to be here.
So you represent the Bayview Chautauqua Inclusiveness Group in this suit. What is happening that this suit is trying to tackle?
It's a bit of a long story. The story starts in 1942 when, unfortunately, this community decided to bring in racial and religious restrictions in who could live in their community. So in the early 1940s, this community said you had to be white and you had to be Christian in order to own a home there. And that's how it went for a period of apparently several years, a little bit more than a decade. It looks like in the late 50s, they eliminated the racial component, but the religious requirement stayed. And it actually evolved over time. Interestingly enough, there was a period where there was a Catholic quota. So we have learned that there were people who actually negotiated to buy a home in this community, and they were told, you know, I'm sorry, we're all full up on our Catholics, and so you're not going to be able to go through with that. So they had a Catholic quota for a period. That apparently has gone by the wayside around the mid-1980s. But what we are left with here today is that this community has a written rule right on the face of its bylaws and procedures that you have to be a practicing Christian with a note from a pastor or a minister or a priest attesting to your religiosity in order to become a homeowner.
Give us a few examples, if you would, of people that you've spoken to, come to know, who feel they've been discriminated against. I guess I'm wondering, what does this Christian litmus test look like and feel like for these people?
Yeah, I mean, so the community has what I'm going to give them all the credit that they're due. They have a wonderful Chautauqua program, which is has a lot of different components, charitable components, to be sure, educational components. And those are largely open to the surrounding community. This is a community very near Petoskey. And so there are people over time who have become involved in this community and participated in these wonderful educational programs.
They go back to the 19th century, the Chautauqua movement. Yeah.
Yes, and they're all over the country, New York, Colorado.
And so these folks have had their children become involved, and they've become interested, for example, in becoming homeowners in this community, but they aren't practicing Christians. And so while they may be welcome to come, may even be welcome to rent a home for a period, they cannot become homeowners in this community. So that's some of the folks who are affected. There are people in the group that I represent who have tried to buy or are looking to buy and have just simply been told that they cannot. There's also a really interesting effect of this kind of rule, which I've found has been quite noted by people in the community. It's that if you are married to a spouse who is not a practicing Christian and you happen to pass away, your spouse cannot inherit the property. If you are the last holder of your marriage, your spouse passes away, now you want to pass down to your children or your grandchildren, you may be able to pass to child A, who is a practicing Christian, but child B cannot partially inherit the home. And so some of the folks that I represent have actually had to get rid of their homes. They're reaching later stages of life. They're trying to do their estate planning, and they're realizing, you know, if I die and this property is in my hands, they're going to do a fire sale and my children aren't going to inherit this property, so we're going to sell. I also represent people who are current owners, but they cannot pass to their wives and husbands and children and whatnot.
So in your view, how does this policy, this Christian litmus test, violate the law? Which laws?
Okay, so there's two major claims in our suit. The first one is sort of the over-the-plate, obvious First Amendment problem here. The First Amendment obviously says the government can't become too entangled or enmeshed in religion. It can't sponsor state religion. It can't prefer one religion over another. And this community has been given by the state of Michigan all kinds of powers that a state usually reserves for itself. So, for example, the private leadership of this community is entitled to pass rules and enforce them on anybody who's in the community, up to and including imposing fines and taking people to jail with their own privately deputized individual who has the power of a sheriff's deputy. So you can imagine a synagogue or a mosque or a church making up a rule that you wouldn't work on their holy day and enforcing that and taking you in for a fine if you work in your home or pass through the streets working. And those are the kinds of rules that are permitted by state law. They've been devolved down to this community at Bayview. And that's just one example. They can assess taxes. They control the streets and the sewers and the docks. They are the state for many purposes based on state law. And at the same time, they have this very Christian identity, and they promulgate the Christian faith. And so the first claim of our suit is that you can't have both. Obviously, you can go be a church and people can go pray in their homes and in their churches and out in the community. Nobody says differently. But when the state is so entangled and enmeshed and you are promulgating one religion and preferring a religion, that's against the First Amendment. So that's the first claim of our suit. The other claim of our suit is to do with federal and state anti-discrimination laws. So one of the questions you see in a lot of dialogue about this case that's been spawned since we filed it is, well, why can't these folks, this is private property, isn't it? Why can't they do what they want to do on their private property? And basically, the answer is, it's the same answer as why Rosa Parks could sit where she wanted on the bus. It's the same answer as to why the lunch counter was desegregated. It's the same answer why we don't have black and white drinking fountains anymore. A lot of those places and entities that were involved in the civil rights movement have been private properties and private businesses. We as a country have said that if you are going to be in the business of buying and selling homes, for example, and lunch and bus rides, you have to follow a certain set of rules that do not allow for discrimination based on race, religion, gender, and whatnot. So we are alleging that Bayview violates federal and state anti-discrimination laws as well.
How does a law called the Summer Resort and Assembly Associations Act fit into the arguments in your lawsuit?
Yeah, it's a really interesting act. It's not something that many people have probably dug into in the past.
I guarantee that.
True. It's an 1889 act. And here's what I think it was trying to do. I think in 1889, what happened is the state said, different communities, you're going to be blessed under this act. You're going to become a summer resort, and we're going to create you out from the body of the state. And we're going to give you all the powers that go along with running a community. So
is that how Bayview got these powers?
Exactly. And so what I think was going on is that in 1889, a place like Petoskey, Michigan was way off the beaten track. Mm-hmm. And so you didn't necessarily have easy access to the state's actual sheriff or the state's taxing authorities. So the state said, you go ahead and run your own community. We're letting you do that. Here's all the things you're going to be empowered to do. And Bayview is one of these communities that has all this special state power. And at the same time, they're trying to be a overtly Christian community at the same time.
So we can take this and say that Bayview is not just a Christian club. It's not a church.
Right. I mean, that is really important to understand. There are really heartfelt religious feelings on both sides of this lawsuit. I mean, this is not an attack or a charge against Christian clubs, Christian organizations, Christian practice, Christian lifestyle, because I'm representing some lifelong dedicated Christians who happen to believe that engagement is really valuable and important, and that they're, you know, called to engage with non-believers as part of their practice of the religion. So this is not a suit that suggests that people shouldn't be allowed to practice their religion in their own way, merely that they can't discriminate in violation of state and federal law, and that they can't be the government and a practicing religion.
And when Bayview residents say, but wait, Bayview was founded as a Chautauqua in the 19th century Methodist campground that people came to for spiritual reawakening, that it was founded for a religious purpose. What do you say to that?
If you go back to the documents of its founding, what they say is that you had to be a person of good moral character in order to participate. They may have believed, like I just described, mm-hmm. some of my clients, that engagement with people who were open-minded but generally good people was a way to proselytize, and it was a way to reach people. They may have believed that there was a division between church and state. They may have believed that, you know, good moral character was really code for Christian. I don't know exactly, you know, where they were with it. But what I do know is that the requirement that in order to own in this community, mm-hmm. you had to be Christian came into being in the 1940s, long after this entity was created. Interesting point, too, is that my clients who are, you know, in their 70s and 80s, remember running around as kids mm-hmm. with Jewish friends, right? So they had other folks living in this community and owning in this community before those rules came into place. And so this concept that, well, we've always been this way and that we, you know, this is our heritage and this is important to us, that's true for the folks who sort of, you know, had their awakening in their, you know, childhood and then later adulthood after the 1940s. But for the older folks, they remember a time when this was not part of Bayview.
So you filed the suit in federal court last July. What's happened since then? Where do things stand?
In the interim, we have worked hard to communicate to Bayview that we have no wish to force this, that we believe that it would be better for Bayview to negotiate a resolution, because when you negotiate, you get to work it out between you rather than have the judge issue a ruling that maybe neither side exactly would have framed that way. And we tried to sit down with Bayview in a mediation, and to their credit, they came to the table to discuss and at least entertain a resolution, and it just didn't go anywhere. So the next steps in the suit will be asking the court to rule outright that based on the facts that nobody is disputing and that we all know are in place, we simply have a violation of the Constitution and state and federal anti-discrimination laws, so that what you get out of that process is a declaratory judgment and an injunction against continuing to enforce those rules.
Attorney Sarah Prescott, who is representing the Bayview Chautauqua Inclusiveness Group in this federal lawsuit, thank you so much for speaking with us.
So good to be here. Thank you so much.
Let's turn now to Dick Crossland. He's a longtime resident of Bayview, and he's seeking to preserve the membership rules. Dick, welcome, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Good to talk with you, Cindy.
So I want to make sure that I'm very clear in my understanding of the Bayview bylaws. So you must be a practicing Christian and also have a note or letter affirming that fact from a pastor or a minister or a priest in order to buy or inherit a home in Bayview?
Yeah, the bylaws say that if you want to become a member and you need to be a member to own a cottage there, you do need to get a letter from a minister or pastor of a church that you attend.
And is it true when Bayview was first founded, the requirement for a prospective owner, a homeowner, was that you needed to be over 21 and of good moral character?
That was what was written. It was understood at the time when Bayview was founded, it was a Methodist church camp. And it was implicit that you were going to be a Christian, not necessarily a Methodist. They made it very clear that they accepted other denominations, but it was implicit that this was intended to be a organization for Christians.
So, Dick, how do you respond to those who believe that the religious restriction in Bayview's bylaws clearly violate constitutional rights, religious rights, civil rights?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I would refrain from, citing the legal arguments. What I would say is that every single person who has taken up the stance and campaigned for an elimination of the Christian requirements joined Bayview, which is a voluntary organization, not only knowing that those were the requirements, but knowing that those were very important requirements. During the interview process, it's stressed that those who are joining our community should be comfortable in upholding our bylaws and supporting our mission. Our mission statement for decades has included the phrase that we're to be a community which provides a Christian perspective in a changing world.
And what of the people whose parents or grandparents owned a home in Bayview, but the next generation can't inherit because, let's say, the spouse is Jewish?
They knew that when they joined, to start out with. I've had a number of people tell me that they are pleased that the cottage inheritance depends upon being a practicing Christian, because many families have seen children grow up, and I know it's not uncommon when you're young in college, first married, to kind of drift away from the faith, and later on when you have kids and settle down a little bit, maybe you come back. And they said that was an incentive for them, because they would tell their children, listen, if you want to inherit the cottage, you need to start becoming involved in a church. And they liked that as a help in their family to bring what were maybe cultural Christians back to more practicing Christians.
Just to be clear, Bayview is not a club or not a church, correct?
Well, again, those are perhaps legal definitions.
But it's certainly not it's not a church.
Well, it may very well not be, but I wouldn't want to characterize it in terms that could be used in a legal sense later on.
Well, when we think of the history of racially and religiously restrictive covenants in this country, it goes back to those early years of the 20th century, and it was created to keep white Protestant neighborhoods white and Protestant, and to keep property prices from going down. And we know in 1948, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the racially restrictive covenants were not enforceable. Why should religious restrictive covenants be interpreted differently?
There is an exception to that, and again, this gets into a legal area that I'm not competent to argue, but the bottom line is Bayview believes it does have a religious exemption to those.
What is the best case scenario in your mind to resolving this lawsuit?
I think the best case is to resolve it internally. We've had a few attempts. We've been unsuccessful in doing that. I think that there are compromises that could be made. I've, as someone who's been very strong in wanting to keep the Christian requirement, have suggested that there might be a way to modify the bylaws so that we could accommodate those families that have had a cottage for generations, and that for one reason or another today it can't be inherited, that we could maybe relax the rules to accommodate those special cases without throwing it completely open. But so far, that's not been something that the other side is willing to entertain.
Dick, what do you think the people who are involved in this lawsuit don't understand? What do you think they're missing?
Well, I think they're missing, quite frankly, what the consequences of this lawsuit could be. The lawsuit is asking for Bayview to be declared a quasi-governmental entity. If that were to happen, we would not only change the membership requirement, but we would lose completely our religious program, because as a quasi-governmental agency, we could not support any religion, let alone Christianity. So the religious program area, which a lot of us consider to be the strongest and most important of the four program areas, would completely be gone. And I think that is, throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I think there should be ways for us to come together without inviting a court to make a decision that perhaps no one would like in the very end.
Dick Crossland is a longtime Bayview resident, and his view is that he's seeking to preserve the membership rules of Bayview. Dick, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Cindy.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Sarah Leeson, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.